So then I came to work. I was not able to enter my office either with the card and the printers. And then after some time, I realized that several colleagues were struggling with the same problem. So that is the reason why I was not able to upload the lecture notes from today's lecture yet. So according to the news from or the message from NTNU, they work on the system, and we have to be patient, and hopefully they are able to fix the issue, and we get back on track. So I will check later today how it goes. So I learned that you have access to Blackboard as normal. Okay. So it started actually this morning with a really weird email saying that in 4 weeks my account and username will be deleted because I have not paid the student fee, or I have been transferred into another position. So, okay. Then I thought, this is spam. And then 2 minutes later, no access to Blackboard. And then I started to, okay, what else? Yeah. So that happens. Yes, so we will start off with what we call the crash course in color science. Because as I mentioned yesterday, most of you, except from the two students from Amir Kabir University, most of you come from a different background. And then we learned from a previous COSY batch that it would be good to have a kind of a couple of hours course in color science to get a kind of the fundamental understanding of colorimetry. So we started two years ago, and that is now the third time that that we will have these approximately 6 hours. And the aim is basically to provide a basic understanding of colorimetry and practical information on color measurements by focusing on color attributes, color measurements, color specification systems, also the relationship between colorimetric values, color attributes, and the color vision mechanism. I listed a PDF on Blackboard yesterday with some of the main literature, and I had already some physical training this morning carrying these books. So do you still know what a textbook is about? Yeah, I mean, you are a digital generation, isn't it? So this is still analog, kind of. I'm just kidding, but yesterday on the Norwegian news, they showed some results from some investigations that youth between, 16 and 18 is only 5% reading analog books, and the remaining, they have no clue, or they are not interested, or they just use digital media. Anyway, we consider these five textbooks as the kind of the main literature for color science. So this is Bob Hunter, a chap who I had in my master course in Derby. He wrote Measuring Colors and also Color Reproduction, which is considered as a kind of one of the main textbooks for color science. I assume you're familiar with Robert Hunt. Then Uta Robertson is probably also famous. Colorimetry, Fundamentals and Applications. Then, of course, Janos Shanda. Some of these experts they are not alive anymore, but they contributed enormous to the CIE, as it is Commission Internationale de l'Éclairage, or the International Illumination Community. I doubt that you will find these online, but there should be several copies in the library. Fourth edition, Roy Burns, Principles of Color Technology, 2019. So that should be available online through NTNU system. Nevertheless, kind of the Polar Science Bible or Quran, that is Visteki styles. So that is the kind of the big book. So I believe there are also several copies in the library. I've not found this book online yet, so... otherwise, if you have a need to get insights and you won't find it in the library, just feel free to get in touch with me. So, yes. Then I divided the three or the lectures into three sessions. So we will have the session now. Related to introduction to human color vision, and then we will continue with color science, and then we will ending to tomorrow a session on the CIE system, standard observer uniform, color spaces, color differences. Okay, any questions so far? Check whether there is a blue light, so I try again to record the lecture. So then I think it's okay. Yes. So to understand color science or the colorimetry, it is a kind of essential to have a kind of an insight in the human color vision. It helps to understand the methods of the CIE. And at the same time, I'm convinced that this will be a kind of a recap for most of you guys talking about rods and cones. And so this is basically high school content. But I think it's good to have a kind of a recap on that. So that is the agenda. Very briefly, why do we see colors? Then we will have a look at the sagittal horizontal section of the human eye, with main focus on the retina. The retinal photoreceptors, the two most familiar or common theories on color vision, also the three component theory and Hering's opponent color theory, and then at the end some insights on what is called univariance. So the ultimate purpose of vision, and indeed of color vision, is to provide us with a representation of the physical objects and the lights in our three-dimensional environment. So I could ask the question, what is color? Any ideas? Any statements? If I ask the question, what is color? What comes to your mind?
So I think it's a frequency that is emitted by an object. So if an object appears as red, so that would mean that it has sort of absorbed all the other frequencies except red. So that is what we can see from you know, and it lies within our visible range, so then we see that object as red.
Okay. So do you believe that in your example, the color is attached to an object?
No, it's not attached to an object, but I think it lies in its nature, that which frequency it would emit and which ones would it absorb.
Okay.
So in some way, sure, it's attached to an object, but I mean, in different lighting conditions, you might find it to appear in a different shade of maybe the same color, but I think it also depends on other environmental factors.
Okay. Good. Any other opinions? Yeah. Please, just go ahead. Yeah. So, yeah. Perception, basically.
Yes, perception. Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. I can hear somehow Ali Said Amir Shahi behind your statement. Yes, that's absolutely right. So what you're saying, you are more a kind of on the Newton side. You know, Newton, he was a physicist, so he basically tried to define light or color in a kind of physical way, and then later on, as we will see, you know, that there were several famous people. One of them I consider Johann Wolfgang Goethe, who was a kind of an excellent poem writer, but his main interest was actually color and perception and visual phenomena. And he opposed Newton, saying that it is not a physical phenomenon, but it is all about perception. Also, the way the brain is interpreting the signals. And nowadays, as you stated, we know that there are some physical parameters, and of course then the brain or the sensor actually capturing the signals, and then the brain interpreting the signals, which then results into perception. Yes. Yeah, with such a question, we can very quickly go into a kind of some what is it called? Philosophical question about. I have a slide later on saying that, okay, now when we have light, we might detect certain color shades. So, does that mean if we switch off the light completely and the room is black, does the color disappear? Or are the colors still attached to the objects? Kind of, yeah. Which could be an exam question, by the way. So.
And what is the answer then?
I'm waiting for your answer. There is no distinct answer. I mean, there is, of course, you need a kind of this understanding that we have some photoreceptors, and these photoreceptors are a kind of sensitive to certain intensities and certain wavelengths, and then on a later stage, it is actually the interpretation of these physical signals which then lead to a kind of a color sensation. So my point is, I see that these seeds to me appear a kind of reddish, but then in the physical world, perhaps everything is just gray, or I don't know what it is called. So, yeah. So don't be afraid when I say it. This will be a kind of an exam question. I mean, there is nothing wrong or right. It's a kind of the way you interpret these type of questions. So, which I think it's kind of exciting because it has a kind of wide range. There is no distinct limitations to that. Yes, so color is a sensation formed by a combination of typically a light source, an object in that case, which is then reflecting the signal and the sensor. So also we know that it is not always necessary to have an object reflecting light. The sun can be a kind of a light source. We also know that if we are really dark adapted, and probably also have experienced that yourself, being in a dark room for some time, and really being dark adapted, you will recognize that there are some flickering going on in the eyeball. So it is not that it is completely pitch black, so we might consider that as noise. So in other words, just one photon may be enough, you know, to trigger the rods. So also there, it's not binary, just black and white. So before we continue, let's consider the different stages in the perception of this particular gray, or we know red strawberry. So that is what I asked you. So is the color attached to the object? So the process starts with a certain light source. In that case, we have this SPD, the spectral power distribution of the daylight. Illuminating the object, the strawberry, which has certain spectral reflectance properties, as you mentioned. So then the spectral reflectance properties determine, as you also mentioned, which part of the light source spectrum is absorbed and what is reflected in that case. And then the trichromatic response, seen here. Responses are processed then into the opponent signals before the signals gets transmitted via the optic nerves to the brain, and finally the color sensation takes place in the visual cortex of the brain. So now we also can ask the question, so why do we see color? It's a very kind of a simple question, and you might find out several good arguments to explain that. So definitely food detection is of importance. Survival mechanism is probably a good thing in certain situations. Now you can imagine this black and white image just demonstrates very schematically how difficult it would be to distinguish between ripe apple and the green apple. So it's quite obvious that the feature color helps us to detect a red apple on green leaves. If you do not have any red-green color deficiency. So we will get back to that also later. Or color is important because it helps us to recognize objects and to discriminate objects from their surrounding. very important also for emotion detection. And navigation, communication, and of course art and pleasure. And again, if somebody has a severe color deficiency or is almost a kind of a monochromate, then it will be rather difficult to navigate in the London tube. So color is important because it helps us to discriminate objects from their surrounding, as I just mentioned. But how important is it? Splitting the image into a chromatic component, so the chromatic information by itself provides relatively limited information, as we can see from that image. But then the achromatic component or information is much more important to preserve fine details. And I mean, that principle is also very, very famous for compression algorithms, as you might know, where typically for video, the color channels are highly compressed, but then the luminance channel mostly remains because it carries the most important information. So how do we perceive this particular gray patch on the left-hand side? So that is what I just mentioned, or what we were discussing five minutes ago. So this happens schematically in two different ways. In the first phase, a physical process takes the light reflected from an object into the retina. And consequently, the interpretation of the information then is processed in the brain, resulting in a perception. And so basically, again, a physical process and a perceptible process. And I mentioned already two important scientists who contributed a lot in understanding of the human color vision. So firstly, Isaac Newton, who was an English physicist and mathematician, who is widely regarded as one of the most influential scientists of all time. So Newton had viewed color as a physical problem involving light striking objects and entering our eyes. So he, on the other hand, Goethe, he reformulates the topic of color in an entirely new way. So as we said, Newton stated color is a product of light at certain wavelengths, whereas then Goethe said color is the product of the observer's mind. You might find plenty of these kind of interaction charts to kind of prove that the color is made in our mind. So let's see whether that is working. So if you steer at the cross in the center, then you can realize this magenta bubbles spinning around, and then after some time you will hopefully detect contrast color or opponent color, which has the color of what?
Greenish,
yes. So the question now would be, are we able to measure the green stimulus on the board or on the screen? Probably not. So that is something happened in our brain, and typically this is what is called after image effects. Okay. Yes. Okay. Good. So we can determine that coloration is based on physical elements such as lights, surface properties, spectral properties, and so on. Secondly, on the physiology, also the study of the function of the organisms or the eye, the sensitivity of the photoreceptors, and lastly, perception or sensation based on the brain interpretation of the signals. We also mentioned that light is radiation in the form of electromagnetic wave that makes vision possible for the human eye. Visible light is distinguished from other forms of electromagnetic radiation by its ability, which is detectable by the retina of the human eye. There is also a tiny area of about 360 nanometer on the short wavelength area, up to maybe 750 nanometer towards the long wave area or near infrared area. So now let's move on with another chapter related to the mechanics of the human eye or of the vision. Very often you can see a kind of a comparison, a very schematically comparison between the eye and the camera. Where the focus mostly is on the optical structure. So from this figure, you can see that the lens of a camera and the lens of our eye have a kind of a similar function, very schematically. And in addition, the aperture has almost the same function in both the eye and the camera. The retina acts or can act as a film, an analog film, or nowadays I would say as a charge coupled device in a digital camera. So then let's discuss the structure of the eye. So the sagittal plane is a vertical plane dividing the body into a right and a left half, as you can see in that image. The eyeball has a shape of a bullet with a diameter of approximately 2.5 centimeters, and the largest part is filled with a clear, colorless fluid that fills the space between the lens and the retina of our eye. So then the cornea. Cornea is the very first refraction surface, which is transparent for UV light down to approximately 290 nanometers. And it has a very great power of more than 40 diopters, which means the reciprocal of 1 divided by 40 meters, which is then equal to, as I said, 2.5 centimeters. And important to know is the fact that irregularities in the cornea will have major consequences for the image quality on the retina. Then the next element is the pupil or aperture, which is an opening in the center of the iris of the eye, and it regulates mainly the amount of light that hits the retina. So the pupil is black in color because the light is absorbed by tissue inside the eye. And in bright light, the pupil has a small diameter of approximately 2 millimeters, and in semi-darkness, it can be up to approximately 8 millimeters. And also we know that humans have round pupils. Other species might have oval pupils or even slit-shaped pupils. This is a schematic overview of the human eye. So the iris, which is the green-gray area, that is this area. Then the pupil in the center of the eye, and what is seen here as white is the sclera. And what is not visible from the image, this is the cornea, the overlying cornea, which is transparent. Any questions so far? This is kind of very fundamental. Yeah. Yes.
So is there a specific reason why our pupil is round and like not formed like the pupil, for example, of a cat?
I don't know.
Okay.
I haven't thought about it. No? Perhaps there might be some answers. Yeah, it could be. I do not have any immediate answer. I don't know exactly through the evolution how this round pupil has been formed. Just speculating, difference between kind of oval opening and a round opening for night vision. I don't know whether you have a kind of a bigger area for night vision with an oval opening compared to a round opening. That's just speculation from my side, but definitely there is one guy out there who has an answer to that, Mr. Google. So I don't know, but can you tell me if you find an answer?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Next element is the lens. So unlike ordinary glass lenses, the eye's lens is flexible in its curvature and thickness. So there is an automatic muscle press, adjust the lens so that we always get a kind of the sharpest possible image, regardless of the distance to the object we are looking at. So in cameras, obviously, this is arranged by varying the distance between the lens and film or CCD as needed. In the eye, it is the lens that changes the shape so that light rays are reflected towards the retinal focus at the back of the eye. Then we talk about the retina. Coming back to the lens, there is also a kind of a well-known phenomenon with the sighting at near distance. So as I said, the lens is flexible in its curvature and thickness, but this is mainly only true, you know, in your age. So coming up to 50, 60 years old, then the lens flexibility is not as big as it was, and therefore it gets more difficult to get a kind of thicker shape. So normally the eye lens might have this type of shape to focus on very long distance. But if you want to read a textbook at close hold, then these ciliar muscles, they need to press the lens so that we have these kind of shape to get near focus. I don't know whether some of you already have noticed that it gets more and more difficult with the age to focus at the close hold, which is called accommodation ability, and then you need kind of corrected glasses for that.
Okay, the retina is considered as part of the central nervous system and is part of the eye that captures the visual impression or basically reads the image or reads the world we see. And it lies as a backdrop inside the eye. So basically that all that is the what is considered as the retina. And it is covered by light-sensitive cells called photoreceptors. And there are two types of such photocells, the rods and the cones. So each eye has approximately 100 million rods and 6 million cones. And the rods get their name from the shape, which is long and cylindrical, while the cones are then shorter and more cone-shaped. So the photoreceptors, as I just said, are in the deepest layer of the retina, and light or photons must first pass through rows of other transparent cells, such as the retinal ganglion cells. So basically the light is entering that image from from the bottom, crossing through different transparent layers like the retinal cells, the amacrine cells, bipolar horizontal cells, and then finally the rods and the cones, the photoreceptors are at the end of that pathway. So basically, the bipolar cells connecting the horizontal cells and the retinal ganglion cells, and the horizontal cells, they connect several photoreceptors together. So then it will generate what is called lateral inhibition. Also extracting signal information not only from one photoreceptor, but from several. And that takes mainly place outside of the fovea. So the fovea mainly contains only cones. There is no rods in the fovea. And then the relationship between a cone and the ganglion cell is 1-to-1. But then on the periphery, there are multiple rods and cones are connected together to a horizontal cell because there is less information. So you need a lot of processing to get the most appropriate information out of it. And as you know, it is all about contrast. That is the way we perceive the world, or we perceive details. It's all about contrast. Also increasing a certain signal and decreasing another signal in the receptive field. Yes. So then basically when light falls onto the retina, it creates a photomechanical reaction in the rods and cones, and then the reaction then continues, as I just said, to the horizontal cells, the bipolar amacrine cells, ganglion cells, and eventually then leaves the retina via the optic nerve to the cortex. This is a comparison of the two retinal photoreceptors, rods and cones. So the rods are sensitive only in lower level of illumination. As I just said, there is basically
just a couple of photons needed to actually being able to distinguish between certain shades. It generates just an achromatic response, as I said, 100 millions. Low acuity, also coming back to the previous slides. So in the fovea, where we only have rods, we also have the best acuity. And then if the signals are moving away from the retina, the acuity is mainly reduced. Yes, no rods in the fovea. On the other hand, the cones responsible for color vision, sensitive only on higher level of illumination, less sensitive than rods, very important only cones in the fovea, and important three types of cones, also what is called L, also long, medium and short wavelength sensitive photoreceptors, also the cones. And also the relationship is not the same. So the least we have the S cones, we also might call kind of in a non-scientific way the blue cones, and the green cones and the red cones, and the relationship is 40 red, 20, approximately 20 green to one blue cone. So very, very often we talk about the red, green and blue photoreceptors. That's okay, but if you need to write a kind of a scientific paper, then please be aware that you should use L, M, and S. So that's also a kind of a policy. Density decreases with distance from the fovea. Light absorption, as I just mentioned, photoreceptor responds to light by absorbing a light quanta in its photopigment, and this is called excitation. And by converting this event to an electrical potential difference. And the difference, again, results into a contrast, or what we call for a contrast. Pigment molecule of a rod is what is called rhodopsin, also called visual purple, consisting of opsin, which is a protein. And retinal, whereas in the L, M, and S cone types, there is another photopigment consisting of a different opsin bound to retinal. Rod and cones response. The terms photopic and scotopic vision are used to reflect the cone and rod vision, respectively. So in photopic vision, that is in that area, only cone cells are active. So this would be then in an all bright light situation. On the other hand, in scotopic vision, the rod cells are functioning only, and this would then be typically in dim light or dark night. And then obviously there is a situation conditions in between, what is called mesopic vision, where both the rods and cones functions together. Then as you can see, so these are the main distinct situations: starlight, moonlight, indoor and natural daylight, related to what is called luminance or brightness. So probably what we have in here is approximately 50 to 200 candela per square meters. So I would consider that as a kind of mesopic type of situation, whereas at least yesterday with sunny bright light we would have up to 100,000 or even 100 million candela per square meters outside, and then it would be only the cones which would be active in the photopic vision. So it's actually enormous, the dynamic range our visual system can preserve. So I'm not aware of any kind of other technical instrument that has this capability. I mean, HDR imaging is also kind of a topic later on in that course, and yeah, it's fascinating, interesting to see what is possible with new display technology, cameras capturing a much brighter dynamic range. Again, you know, I grew up in an analog world with film. Also there in the 70s, 80s, we were talking about high dynamic range images. And now this has moved into the digital world. But to compete with our visual system, okay, now I talked 45 minutes. I need a cup of coffee. Let's have a break, and we continue at 11:15. Okay. Good. Oh, let's see what we have access now.
Yes. but I went to look at shoes one day and I see the shoes have 10 steps.
The urge of like getting up.
You said the shoes had stats?
Yeah, like there was like. So I didn't really know what the numbers were, but they had like numbers, pictures.
Okay. Okay, let's continue. So, related to photopic vision, the luminous efficiency function or photopic luminosity function describes the overall spectral sensitivity of human visual perception of brightness. So in other words, the luminous efficiency means that for a given wavelength of electromagnetic radiation, it is the relative ability to induce a sensation of light. So this is a plot of the photopic luminosity function versus wavelengths of radiation. So it has long been recognized that the ability of the receptors in the retina to absorb electromagnetic radiation depends on the wavelengths of the radiation. And as you can see, almost 100 years ago, the International Commission on Illumination created a standard photopic luminosity function for photometric measurement, which is this function here. And for the human eye, an efficiency of 1 was assigned to the wavelengths of 555 nanometers. So this is the photopic, also the cone-related luminosity function, or the VV lambda function. And as we can see in this graph, the sensitivity functions of rods and cones are not equal. So in the previous slide, we saw that function, the V lambda function, with the peak of 555 nanometers. So the rods show the maximum sensitivity at 501 nanometer, while the maximum sensitivity of the cones is 50 nanometers moved towards the long wavelength area. There is also a bit difference between the CIE sensitivity functions for photopic conditions of 1931 and 1971. So this is the 78 photopic V lambda, and the rod sensitivity function is what is called V prime lambda, okay? Related to the photopic and scotopic luminosity function, there is also a well-known phenomena called Purkinje shift or Purkinje effect. So the maximum sensitivity of night vision is shifted slightly towards towards shorter wavelengths compared to today vision. So again, this is the V lambda, the cone sensitivity function, and V prime lambda is the rod luminosity function. So coming back to this visual phenomenon, compared to red flowers, the blue ones, therefore, appear relative brighter in the night than during the day. So if you imagine, okay, now it's getting dark at night more and more. So if you're in daytime down in the center in the park where we have kind of flowers, tulipan flowers, red, and blue tulipans. So during the day, the red tulipans might appear slightly brighter compared to the blue tulipan. But if you go back at night, where there is really pitch black and no street light contaminating the view, and you adapt to the darkness, there is one type of flower which appears a kind of gray, and the other one is pitch black. And that is actually the blue tulipans, which appear then a kind of grayish, whereas the red, which are during the daytime, are much brighter, they appear pitch black. And that is due to the shift of V lambda in daytime towards V prime lambda in the night. And the Czech anatomist Jan Evangelista Purkinje has basically published that phenomenon. I don't remember exactly, 1827, if I remember correctly. Yeah. So are you aware of this kind of effect? Have you observed that kind of? No? Okay. So next time there is party downtown, midnight, especially October, November, then it's really dark. Then you might see that.
So in essence, it means that colors more closer to blue appear bright in dark mode than colors that are closer to red. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That's correct interpreted, yeah. So it's really amazing. So so my daughter, she wanted to have a dog, and it was a very tough battle.
battle to resist. So finally we ended up with a dog, and now it's me who has to go with the dog in the morning and in the afternoon. And I remember, I think it was last year during winter time, there was no snow, so I wear a kind of a Coca-Cola red jacket. And then the leash was a kind of a cyan color, or so a blue color. And I had the leash bound around my arm, and I went into the woods. And it was pitch black. And suddenly I got astonished seeing this kind of very light blue leash around the really black jacket. And it was really astonishing how bright it appeared. And there was no street lighting, nothing. Then I remembered that was the greetings from Purkinje. Oh, it's kind of an interesting phenomenon. Okay.
Yeah.
V lambda daylight, V prime lambda is night. Yeah. The fovea, mentioned that already, is the small pit in the retina at the back of the eye, of about 1.5 millimeter in diameter, centered on the larger macula lutea, also called the yellow spot. So as I said, it contains only cones responsible for color vision, and it is the area where we have where the vision is most acute. Then here there is the blind spot, the place of the retina where the optic nerve fibers leave the eye, and there is no photoreceptors at all. And so the blind spot can be confirmed by a simple experiment using two points in a suitable distance from each other. I am not sure whether you are able to find your blind spot here on the wall. If you have the notes later today, probably you can test that, or maybe I have some paper, so you can find your own blind spot then. Ah, okay, here we go. So if you distribute, some of these papers, then the point is you need to find your own blind spot by closing the left eye, and you steer at the cross with the right eye, okay? So you close the left eye, and then you steer with the right eye to the cross, and you move the piece of paper forward and back, and then suddenly at approximately 20-25 centimeters, the black spot disappears, and that means you have focus directly on the blind spot where there are no photoreceptors.
But then what does this have to do with how far it is from my eye?
That you focus the round spot directly on the retina where there is no photoreceptors.
Okay, so when it comes,
so there is an area. In that area there are no photoreceptors. So that means in daily life, you know, you compensate, you know, for this missing sensor pixels. But then if you have a distinct spot, and that spot falls exactly in that area, then that spot is not visible. And that you're doing, for instance, by holding the left eye closed, and then you focus on the X, and then suddenly at a certain distance, the round spot disappears. But you have to focus on the X, and then perhaps that approximately 20, 25 centimeters, you are not detecting the black spot.
So I can still see the cross. That would mean that
the
light that is being emitted from that region is not being focused at the blind spot.
Exactly. So the cross might be here or there or there.
Right.
And the black then dot is there.
So
I mean, in the daily life, you don't think about it. So.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Could you detect?
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
Yes, then this graph shows the photoreceptors density distribution. So the number of rods, which is the dotted line. So the dotted line shows the distribution of the rods. And the blue line demonstrates the distribution of the cones. And this is the fovea at 0 degrees and the respective angles away from the fovea. So now you can see that in the fovea, as we stated, there are hardly no rods at all. But then on the periphery, there are mainly rods and vice versa. There are hardly no cones, only in the fovea. Okay. Yes, and then that is the blind spot, a couple of degrees or 20 degrees away from the fovea. Okay. That picture shows a schematic cone distribution or a cone mosaic for an individual with rather normal color vision. It also demonstrates the density of the L, M, and S cone in the retina, which we have seen is in relationship 40L. 20M and only one blue or S cone. This presentation is in some respect misleading. It shows the spectral sensitivities of the cones after the publication of Stockmann and Sharp back in 2000 with 10 degrees quartal cone fundamentals, which is normalized to equal peak value of 1, as you can see here, on a linear vertical scale. So I just said it is a kind of misleading because it distorts the functional relationship between the light wavelength, also the energy, the cone sensitivity, and the color perception. However, comparisons with the photopigment absorptions curves identifies three obvious differences between the shape and peak sensitivity of the photopigments and the cone fundamentals. So the L cone, that is the red Gaussian curve, has a noticeable broader or wider curve than the S and M cones, and the S cone has a narrower response profile compared to the M and L. However, this is a very widely used graph to visualize the spectral sensitivities of cones in a linear scale. So if we look at the cone absorptions in a different scale, in a log normalized cone sensitivity function, then that is a much better solution to present the normalized curves as shown here. So basically, the problem with a linear normalize cone fundamentals as seen just previously is that they emphasize the overall peak shapes of the curves. As a result, they do not adequately display the tails as seen here. So this is what we call the tails. So each unit of the log sensitivity scale here is 10 times smaller than the unit before, which then zooms in on the very low sensitivity. So basically, it is the same representation. It is just on a vertical log scale. So be beware of that, and basically it's rather straightforward to convert between the different scales. The third one, I think, is a very interesting graph. So this is probably the most accurate picture of the proportional response probabilities of the three cone classes in relation to each other, to different wavelengths of light and to the overall visual acuity. So this is the linear population weighted linear cone sensitivity function. And as you can see, the cone sensitivity, the total cumulative response is 1. So then the L is contributing approximately 0.65. The M approximately 0.3. And very little contribution from the S cones. So the cumulative response then is up to 1. So the L and M cones produce nearly all the information acquired by the retina. So the L cones account for most of the retinal signals at nearly all wavelengths, as you can see. So when we recall that the fovea contains half of the total number of L and M cones in the retina, the curves indicate the dominant importance of the foveal response in the color vision. And again, that also relates to the distribution, as mentioned previously. So for one S cone, we have approximately 20 M cones and 40 M cones, and that is noticeable in that distinct graph. So, if we relate that to a design, looking at blue text on a black background, it's very hard to get a reasonable contrast. So it's only the short wavelength cone that distinguishes between black and blue. So again, black text on blue background or vice versa is almost non-legibility. And similar would then be the opponent color, yellow on white, where the contrast also is very, very small. So there is a relationship between the number of cones and the sensitivity. Okay, to summarize the previous slides, rod vision is achromatic, resulting in poor details and no color detection. On the other hand, the sensitivity of the rod receptors are high. A long time ago, I found this kind of sketch, this schematic visualization of the retinal image. It is obviously very schematically, but it shows the most important points. So firstly, you can see the image is upside down, and that we know also from the camera or camera obscura. Only the central area of the retina, the fovea, has high spatial resolution and is sensitive to color. So basically just this area, and the sharpness is also just this sharp there. The periphery of the retina has a low resolution and can mostly detect lightness changes. And lastly, the blind spot, where there is no information detected. Okay, then coming back to the exam question. A former colleague, Arne Wahlberg, who unfortunately died 92 years old just before the summer holiday, he wrote several textbooks in color and color vision. And in one of his textbooks, I found this kind of four statements about where are the colors when it is dark. So for instance, when it gets dark, our qualitative experience of color disappears. But once the light is turned on, we perceive colors and contrast again. Does that mean that the color never disappeared? Or does it just mean that there is too little light, that the cones can respond to the color which are always there? And lastly, or isn't color a physical element that is always present? I like this these quotes because it kind of sums up what we just talked about. Okay, then let's discuss the two most dominant theories explaining how color vision is functioning. So let's start with Young-Helmholtz three receptor theory. So like most people, Thomas Young, an English physicist, 250 years ago, assumed that there were three basic colors, namely the painter's yellow, ice blue, and purple. But then he noticed that the spectrum of sunlight was dominated by the shades of red, green, and blue, violet. And he therefore thought that these represented the basic sensation of the visual system, and those the basic colors of the color circle. So then in 1802, Thomas Young postulated the existence of three type of photoreceptors, now known as the cone cells in the eye, each of which was sensitive to a particular range of visible light. Then 50 years later, in 1850, Hermann von Helmholtz developed the theory further, saying that the three types of cone photoreceptors could be classified as short preferring, also the blue one, middle preferring green, and long preferring the red, according to their response to the wavelengths of light striking the retina. And then finally, the signals detected by the three types of cones are interpreted by the brain as a visible sensation or a visible color. And this formed the Young-Helmholtz theory, which is the theory of the trichromatic color vision. And as in many other occasion or situation. So that was a kind of a very clear statement, and every clear statement gives room for a kind of counter argue, and that also happens in the vision community. So then hearing. He was a German physiologist who did much research into color and also spatial perception. He disagreed completely with the leading theory developed by mostly Helmholtz, and stated that the human eye perceived all colors in terms of three primary colors. So that was a statement from Young and Helmholtz. So Haring, he looked more at the qualitative aspects of color and said that there were six primary colors coupled in three pairs, namely blue, yellow, red, green, and an achromatic axis, white and black. And do you remember one hour ago when we detected these magenta bubbles, and then suddenly a green appeared? So that is the proof of Haring's opponent color theory. And his theory was then rehabilitated back in the 70s, also by a very famous researcher, Edwin Land. Does everybody know Edwin Land? No? So he has established what is called a retinex theory that stated that whereas Helmholtz colors hold for the eye, in the brain, the three colors are translated into six. So therefore, the word retinex is formed from retina, as what is happening in the eyeball, and the sensation happening in the cortex. And by the way, Edwin Land, that's my point. He was an American scientist and inventor, best known as the co-founder of the Polaroid color system, or the Polaroid camera, back in the 50s, 60s, 60s. So to summarize the two competing theories about color vision, Young-Helmholtz trichromatic theory, there are three type of color receptors in the retina, one for red, one for green, one for blue. On the other hand, Haring's opponent process theory, each of the three cone types respond to different wavelengths. And also Schrödinger back in 1920, 100 years ago, demonstrated that the first and the second model are mathematically equivalent. So it's quite interesting. So I just mentioned now a couple of famous people, and a lot of these people, they were very proactive 100 years ago. And later today, starting with color science and colorimetry, again, we are back in 1928, in 1931, and 1962, and this is all about color science. And now we believe in 2022 that we reinvent the world. That's not the case. It's just interesting, you know, how much we relate back to really huge kind of founders. Okay. Yeah, and this plot shows then the stages of the visual process that occurs in the retina, and it is very, very oversimplified and hypothetical representation of possible types of connections between retinal receptors and some nerve fibers. So basically, starting with the visual response or the visual spectrum with the RADS and the LMNS, the adaptation process with the neurons generating an opponent signal. Also the opponent signal in the achromatic phase, the transmission to the brain, and then the final perception. So I won't go into the details. I mean, just that could lead to a kind of several classes, and this is the details are kind of outside of my knowledge, talking about higher pathway V4 and V3 interpretation of the signals. But at the same time,
that is also a lot of room for further research. But on the Color Lab, unfortunately, there is no kind of vision scientist kind of employed yet, even though we were talking about for a couple of years now that we should have a kind of a pure vision scientist. We do have a psychologist with their expertise in perception, but not a scientist with mainly focus on vision. So there is another group in Kongsberg, and this group works mainly in color vision. They also do quite a lot of work in color vision deficiency, but not in Gjøvik. Because we started kind of more from computer science than from the biological side or neurophysiological side, whereas then Kongsberg, they just are the opposite. So, okay, then finally, kind of interesting phenomenon, univariance in color vision. So the principle of univariance is how one can discriminate between wavelengths through comparison of multiple photoreceptors. So the principle states that one and the same visual receptor cell can be excited by different combination of wavelengths and intensity, so that but the brain is not able to know the color of a certain point of the retinal image. So if you have a single type of cone, as shown here, the cone cannot distinguish changes in wavelength, shown here with that very narrow band light with lower intensity and kind of narrow band light in the long wavelength area with higher intensity. So the M cone will respond equally to a dim green as to a bright red light. So as far as the M cones are concerned, these two lights appear the same. A given light will excite the L, M, and S cones differently and finally produce then different L, M, and S cone responses. So if we have a kind of a blue light, it provides this type of responses, having our three cones, similar to the green light or a red light. So when we also predict L, M, and S responses to different level of saturations, so if you have a very narrow band light, we end up with these responses, and very similar responses we obtain with brighter, more saturated light as well. Given almost any light, it's possible to find intensities of the three primaries that produce the same L, M, and S. So having this very bright light and having then this narrow blue, green, and red, they result into the same L, M, S responses.
Okay. Go forward. Yeah, the difference between like the wave graph and the graph.
Okay. So this indicates schematically a light source. Okay? So a blue light source, a green light source, and a red light source. And now in that case, we have all three cones available.
compared to the very first one. So that was the main point. Having only one cone, basically we have just an achromatic signal. So we need more than one. So two, it works. We know there are some dichromats, also people who have only two functioning cones. So then they have a kind of a reduced color vision, but still they are able to distinguish between color stimuli. But a monochromat who has only one function and either a cone or no cone at all, only rods. So these are the people need to wear sunglasses all the time because it is so bright light. They can distinguish only different gray shades. So and that is the principle of univariance. So if you have only one receptor, then you cannot distinguish between wavelengths, green and red, and intensity. So you need at least two, or as most of us have, three, or perhaps some of the ladies might even have four cones. No?
Well, I mean, I understand why we can distinguish between different wavelengths in this case, but why shouldn't we distinguish between intensities? Because, like you mentioned, we have kind of a black-gray scale image, and we can distinguish intensity of the gray.
Right. But if you look at that shape of this Gaussian curve or this cone, so in that case you have this tiny intensity which just fits into that area of 500 nanometers or what it is. So then you have a much higher intensity indicating by that line. But it ends up on that curve. Exactly. So then for the sensor, it doesn't matter whether it is very bright or very very dim, because I can detect only up to that range. Yeah. So then I need another one, another detector. And then I get this additional information. Okay, so that is the kind of the principle of univariance, and that at the very end, the main point I want to make, also because of the principle of univariance, two different spectra can produce the same L, M, and S cone responses with exactly the same perception. So in that case, we have this kind of very broad band, kind of whitish light. This gives this response. Or we can have this narrow band lighting, and it gives exactly identical response. So the principle of univariance means that color must be defined by the combined responses of all three cone types. And these pairs are called metamers. And they can make what is called a metameric match. So either this is afternoon or then next week we will talk more about metamerism. So metamerism, you will get very much familiar with metamerism during the course. So basically, due to the fact that most of us have only three cones, we can have two different situations with lighting responses, but we are ending up with the same numbers for S, M, and L. And then the two stimuli look the same. also you are fully aware of that type of phenomenon in the daily life. So for instance, if you have some black trousers and you go into a shop and you want to have a black T-shirt, or let's say gray is a kind of, it's easier to understand. You have gray trousers, you go into a shop with incandescent lamp, for instance, as a bulbs. You find a T-shirt which visually matches the gray trousers. Then you go outside, daylight, and your colleague says, there is a mismatch between, a visual mismatch between the trousers and the T-shirt. And that is what this is about. And that can be a kind of in a color reproduction setting where you have a display and you have a viewing booth reflecting a kind of an object with different illumination as the display, but under a certain condition the visual match holds. But if you would measure with a color measurement or a spectroradiometer, you would obtain different values, but perceptibly it's a match. And that is what metamerism is about. We also talk about observer metamerism. Even though most of us, or perhaps all of us, they have functioning cones, but we do not have exactly the same color vision, even though these cones are functioning. So basically what I'm talking about is, if I go back, why is that not working?